Good morning and welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Iran's secret plan to escalate the war. Intercepted communications and other intelligence suggest a strategic shift by hardline leaders to raise the costs for the U.S. and its regional allies, by Benoit Fasson and Summer Saeed. After President Trump signed a memorandum of understanding with Iran in mid-June, administration officials fanned out to build support for an agreement they hoped would reopen the Strait of Hormuz and start winding down the war. Iran's hardline leaders huddled in Tehran and came up with a different plan, according to Iranian and Arab officials. In their view, the pact was likely just an attempt by the U.S. and Israel to take pressure off the global economy and buy time for a bigger attack down the road. Instead of putting faith in talks, they took the past 2 months to prepare for a bigger fight. Their efforts include giving the powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps more control of the country's regular army, appointing hardened veterans of the war with Iraq and past internal crackdowns to key posts, expanding domestic counterintelligence operations, and ramping up production of missiles and drones. The leadership quickly seized the initiative, attacking ships to tighten Iran's grip on Hormuz and expanding the battlefield to the Red Sea, which Saudi Arabia has used to get around Iran's chokehold on the Persian Gulf. Arab intelligence officials have picked up evidence, including communications between Iran and militia allies in countries such as Yemen and Iraq, of a strategic shift inside the country's hardliner leadership to get their forces ready to widen the war and raise the costs for the U.S., officials familiar with the findings say. Alarming weaker Gulf countries like Kuwait, Iran's leaders are increasingly talking about offensive operations on enemy territory. Their overriding goal is to inflict enough pain to ensure the kind of attacks Iran has endured with the 12-day war last year and the continuing conflict aren't repeated. There is also a widespread view in Iran that the main war has not yet begun, said Mohammad Hassan Sangtarash, a Tehran-based defense analyst close to the Iranian government. What we have seen so far is increasingly interpreted through the lens of salami-slicing tactics, limited incremental escalation designed to weaken capabilities before a larger confrontation. The Iranian preparations point to an enormous gulf between how Washington and Tehran are perceiving this stage of the war. The divergence has driven a hardline negotiating stance and reluctance to close deals by Iran's leaders that has persistently flummoxed Trump, who has called them crazy and accused them of lying. Iran's readiness to fight also highlights a deep lack of trust that is likely to keep the two sides from reaching a durable deal to end the conflict anytime soon. Iran's proclamations include plenty of bravado. The country's military and economic base have been battered by the U.S. and Israeli airstrikes. More pragmatic members of the leadership, including Iranian President Mossad Pezhkani, have repeatedly warned Iran needs to negotiate a deal to end the war that brings sanctions relief or face the collapse of its economy. But Iran is rebuilding its infrastructure and restoring access to missile bases much more quickly than expected, a concern to Israeli officials who are familiar with the progress. It also has successfully targeted U.S. bases and retains enough firepower to threaten ships and Gulf energy infrastructure. Arab officials are bracing for continued fighting and an extended disruption of energy supplies. For the regime, the baseline is war, said Alan Eyre, a former senior U.S. diplomat and nuclear negotiator with Iran. Iran will remain on a wartime footing, preparing for a subsequent attack. When Trump signed the Memorandum of Understanding with Iran on June 17 at the French Palace of Versailles, it looked like the biggest hurdle would be convincing American critics that it wasn't overly generous to Tehran. The deal promised sanction waivers to let Iran sell its oil, access to billions of dollars in frozen cash, and the prospect of a $300 billion fund to rebuild the country. Iran's main obligation was to open the Strait of Hormuz to shipping traffic and then negotiate in good faith on its nuclear program. When Iran started shooting at ships the U.S. was guiding through the strait 3 weeks later, in early July, it caught the U.S. by surprise. "The very dangerous people from Iran, they're sick," said Trump, who also called Iran's leaders scum. "There's something wrong with them." In fact, Iran was pursuing a two-track policy. While his diplomats pursued a peace deal with the U.S., Iranian leader Mujibta Khamenei was taking steps to prepare the security apparatus for an expanded confrontation that may be initiated by Tehran itself. The Revolutionary Guard used the calm created by the Memorandum of Understanding to lay the groundwork with allied militias around the region to step up attacks if needed, sending advisors to Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon to discuss the plans, the officials familiar with recent Arab intelligence findings said. The intelligence included intercepted communications showing the Revolutionary Guard sending commanders to areas controlled by Yemen's Houthis to plan for a stepped-up confrontation with Saudi Arabia in coordination with the Iraqi militaries that also are backed by Iran. The Revolutionary Guard supervised deployments of missiles, naval weapons, and drone launchers to positions overlooking the Red Sea. It also provided the Yemeni militants with intelligence, target lists including Saudi ports and energy facilities, and advice on sheltering from Saudi retaliation, the officials said. The result was fighting that escalated through late July. The Houthis struck Yemeni government forces backed by Saudi Arabia and declared the Bab al-Mandab Strait that links the Red Sea to world markets closed to Saudi Arabia. The militant group has fired on Saudi ships, complicating the kingdom's efforts to export its oil and raising the supply risks for global markets. Around the same time, Saudi Arabia said Iran-backed militias in Iraq had launched drone attacks on its oil facilities. The Revolutionary Guard threatened Gulf states that it would destroy their energy facilities if the U.S. were to hit similar sites in Iran, going as far as sending detailed lists of individual targets to its Arab counterparts, the officials said. Iran also escalated its attacks on American troops. Tehran surprised the U.S. by firing 5 ballistic missiles at Jordan during a lull in the conflict. The attack came 2 weeks after another Iranian strike in Jordan killed 3 U.S. service members. Officials in the Gulf grew more alarmed as they watched the scope of attacks grow and Iranian missiles evade U.S. defenses and hit targets more precisely in Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain. The fighting spilled into August, with Iran striking 6 United Arab Emirates ships over the past 2 weeks as they tried to transit the Strait of Hormuz. "We took full advantage of the ceasefire period," Revolutionary Guard spokesman Brigadier General Hassan Mohebi said in an interview with the Guard-affiliated Tanznim news agency in July. "We enhanced our capabilities, accelerated our missile production rate, and improved missile accuracy." Behind the scenes, Supreme Leader Khamenei was positioning his forces for a more aggressive fight, lining up 7 key security leaders to run revamped military and repression institutes in a reorganization that was unveiled a week ago. The appointments came with aggressive goals that included tightening the military chain of command, turning an ideological militia into a neighborhood intelligence agency, and emphasizing an offensive approach. Moshe Rezaghi, who led the Revolutionary Guard during the war with Iraq in the 1980s, was named Secretary of Iran's top decision-making body, the Supreme National Security Council, where he will be Khamenei's representative. In the past week, the council squelched progress on a deal to gradually open Hormuz. To step up internal security, Khamenei returned veteran Hossein Taib, a close associate who led a deadly crackdown on protests in 2009, to the helm of the besiege. The supreme leader tasked him with pivoting the volunteer force into a popular intelligence network in the wake of two wars that showed how thoroughly Iran had been breached by Israeli intelligence. Iranian government advisors see the next stage of the confrontation going beyond conventional warfare to include external attempts to foster domestic unrest. The government brutally suppressed protests over the country's economic crisis in January and fears it's only a matter of time before the continued deterioration under U.S. pressure brings demonstrators back to the streets. Khamenei also consolidated Revolutionary Guard influence over the regular army by unifying control of the two military arms under Brigadier General Ali Abdollahi, a veteran Revolutionary Guard senior commander and military leader who has aggressively advocated attacks on Arab states hosting U.S. bases around the Persian Gulf. New Revolutionary Guard Commander-in-Chief Ahmad Vahidi, who has been unofficially on the job since March, was formally given the position and tasked with powerful offensive operations against the enemy, the decree appointing him said Monday. The next day, General Mohammad Reza Naghidi, an advisor to Vahidi, said the paramilitary force must be prepared to take operations into enemy territory. Vahidi's elevation is consistent with the leadership preparing the security establishment for a period of sustained confrontation rather than a return to normal peacetime politics, said Saeed Golkar, an expert on Iran's security services at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. The Revolutionary Guard, an armed force nearly 200,000 strong, has devised new plans for further escalation, including preemptive strikes, according to Iranian officials and public statements. Among the options, sabotaging internet cables in the Persian Gulf, creating political unrest in countries with Shia communities, such as Kuwait and Bahrain, and potentially even ground operations in Kuwait. Kuwait takes those risks seriously. In early May, the tiny Gulf sheikdom said its security forces had intercepted six Revolutionary Guard troops that used a rented fishing boat to land a Kuwaiti island separated from Iran only by a thin strip of Iraqi territory. Some Iranian political figures have suggested the Revolutionary Guard could launch ground raids via southern Iraq if the U.S. were to threaten Iranian territory like Karga Island. Some Gulf officials said Iran's recent behavior is fueling uncertainty about relations with the much larger, newly more aggressive neighbors after the war. They say it remains difficult to assess the extent of the damage the U.S. and Israel did to the Revolutionary Guard's capabilities. Still, it's clear the organization hasn't been defeated or deterred, and its hold on Hormuz has strengthened its regional position, they said. That reality has helped push Gulf states to support even unfavorable deals that would acknowledge Iranian oversight of the strait if it stops further escalation, But regional leaders are also growing more frustrated by the lack of fundamental changes in Tehran's behavior in response to diplomatic outreach. Iran's security-minded leadership, they said, appears to be growing more confident in its demands. Mediators in the talks said Iranian diplomats agreed early in the month on a deal with Oman to set up and oversee routes through Hormuz that would lead to the gradual reopening of the strait. Those efforts were blocked by the Revolutionary Guard, which went back to attacking ships. With negotiations blocked and Iran not backing away from escalating the fight, Trump has stepped back to see if the economic pressure from sanctions and the Navy's blockade will soften Iran's position, U.S. officials said. But Iran's leaders are deeply skeptical of Trump's motives and are slipping into a survival economy aimed at holding out. People close to Iran's top negotiators have warned peace talks could be just an interlude before more conflict. Mehdi Mohammadi, a strategic advisor to Chief Iranian Negotiator Mohammad Bagdar Ghalibaf, described the current stalemate Tuesday as the calm before the storm. In an earlier social media post, Mohammadi said the drivers of continued conflict include a generational project for blood vengeance for the killing of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, Mojtabi's father, in the opening strikes of the war. The Iranian nation still has much unfinished business with Trump, said Mohammadi, who is also a member of Iran's negotiating team. Iran is prepared for the great confrontation. And on to our next story. Politics, policy. Trump's ballroom was his dream of beauty and space. Now it's a military complex. As courts have questioned the president's authority for the project, he has leaned into arguments of national security by Will Hobson and Luis Rudnovsky. President Trump's vision for a White House ballroom stretches back more than a decade. His argument that it is vital to our national security, which culminated Friday in an appeal to the Supreme Court, is far more recent. When Trump announced last year that he was demolishing part of the White House to make way for the project, he framed it as a matter of aesthetics and space. It will be a great legacy project, and I think it will be special, the president said that July. I think it will be really beautiful. Trump, on that day, and many others, said it was unbefitting of a nation of the U.S.'s stature to have to erect temporary tents for large events. When it rains, it's a disaster, he said, and the tent is 100 yards. That's more than a football field away from the main entrance, and people are schlepping down to the tent. It's not a pretty sight. Trump raised the ballroom idea in 2010 in a private phone call with David Axelrod, then the senior advisor to President Barack Obama. The conversation came in the midst of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and Trump called to suggest he could help. After Axelrod politely declined, Trump offered to build a White House ballroom. They turned it down, Trump said on the campaign trail in 2016. I was going to put up $100 million to build a ballroom at the White House because having a tent is not that good. The same year, the Obama White House laughed off the suggestion. I'm not sure it would be appropriate to have a shiny gold Trump sign on any part of the White House, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said at the time. In a signing ceremony shortly after returning to office last year, Trump said he had been rebuffed on the ballroom three or four times, including during the Biden administration, but joked he would be that much more receptive to his own proposal now that he occupied the White House. I'm going to try and make the offer to myself, you know, because we could use a bigger room, he said. The White House news release on the project last July touted the need for a large event space on the White House complex that can hold substantially more guests. It said the Secret Service will provide the necessary security enhancements and modifications. Construction began in September, and the demolition of the East Wing soon followed. The first major legal challenge was filed in mid-December. An early Justice Department legal submission cited the tent issue and emphasized the president's role as the sole organ of American foreign policy, requiring him to be able to receive ambassadors and other public ministers in an appropriate setting. It is entirely fitting, then, that the presidential residence and workplace be equipped for that purpose, the government said. Given modern needs, the White House is not. By January, the administration's legal arguments on security were growing, with its lawyers telling a judge that halting the construction project midstream would endanger the safety of the president and others who work in the White House. Secret Service Deputy Director Matthew Quinn added in a court declaration that a permanent structure for screening guests and hosting events would also increase the safety and security of all attendees at those events, including the president and foreign leaders and dignitaries. In late March, Trump was in a press gaggle aboard Air Force One, shared renderings of the project, and emphasized the security upgrades that he said came at the request of the military. They wanted additional security, drone-proof roofing, and reinforced glass, he said, and unfortunately, we're living in an age where that's a good thing. 2 days later, the U.S. Judge Richard Leon ordered construction of the ballroom to halt above ground unless it was blessed by Congress. The Justice Department quickly appealed, and construction has been allowed to continue in the interim. Hours after a shooter attempted to break into the White House Correspondents Association dinner in late April, Trump said the incident underscored why the ballroom was a security necessity. Administration lawyers, meanwhile, that month offered an appeals court an unusually detailed window into national security planning as part of their bid to save the construction. More recently, Trump has posted a series of renditions on social media of what purports to be the ballroom's roof, filled with drones, trucks, and soldiers. An appeals court this month said the fact remained that Trump didn't have the legal authority to build the project without congressional approval, adding the administration didn't make such sweeping security claims earlier in the litigation. Still, the court paused its ruling from taking effect for 2 weeks to give the White House a chance to go to the Supreme Court. When the administration did so on Friday, its lawyers cited a string of incidents as proof that the updated East Wing complex is absolutely required. They included the correspondence dinner incident, as well as a thwarted plot to attack June's UFC cage fighting match on the White House lawn and the threat of a missile attack against Air Force One on July 8. They also included two events that had occurred before Trump returned to the White House: the July 2024 Butler, PA campaign rally, when Trump's ear was struck by a sniper's bullet, and a second assassination attempt in September 2024 at Trump International Golf Club in Florida. In a Friday night social media post, Trump referred to the ballroom project as a military complex and a desperately needed national security structure for the people of the United States of America. Last year, when Fox News' Jesse Waters got time with Trump, the president identified another reason driving his desire. He said, Jesse, it's a monument. Waters told a crowd at a Turning Point USA event in December, I'm building a monument to myself because no one else will. And on to our next story. Politics, elections, rural economic pain tests the GOP's grip on a Trump stronghold. Democrats are seeing signs of hope in traditionally Republican Iowa, by John McCormick. The arrival of late summer state fairs like the ones here that feature a prize-winning boar weighing 1,246 pounds, signals to the political world that the midterm campaign's final chapter is just ahead. As Iowa's 11-day extravaganza started late last week, the state's Republicans found themselves in an unfamiliar position, trailing Democrats in a top race and facing serious challengers in several others. Some GOP candidates didn't mention President Trump, viewed more unfavorably than favorably in a recent Fox News poll of Iowa voters during their highest-profile fair appearances. Democrats, meanwhile, are pouring millions into the state's races as rural economic pains from Trump's tariffs and the war on Iran erodes GOP support amid stagnant grain prices and higher fuel and fertilizer costs. Iowa, which backed Trump by 13 percentage points in 2024, is now an unexpected battleground despite years of GOP dominance. All six members of its congressional delegation are Republicans, and the Democratic National Committee was so disillusioned with Iowa, it ended a roughly five-decade tradition of Iowa hosting the party's first presidential nominating contest. Republicans are expected to keep it first for 2028. Just 3 years ago, Trump dominated the fair as a presidential candidate. His Boeing 757 circled overhead several times, even before he arrived on a day when four other presidential candidates were there competing for attention ahead of the state's leadoff nominating caucuses. This year, Iowa's Republican nominee for governor didn't mention the president in his appearance on the Des Moines Register's political soapbox, where candidates speak to fairgoers and to throngs of media. I talk about Iowa, Zach Lahn, who's endorsed by Trump, said later when asked about the omission in his Friday speech. Joe Mitchell, the GOP nominee for a Northeast Iowa congressional race, also didn't mention Trump during his soapbox appearance. His district is rated as lean Republican by the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. Lahn has trailed his Democratic opponent, State Auditor Rob Sand, in every public poll this summer. In the U.S. Senate race, Josh Torek, a state representative and former Paralympic wheelchair basketball medalist, led in one poll this summer, and Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson was narrowly ahead in the rest. The businessman and farmer said he expects Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will join him soon on the Iowa campaign trail. Lahn, like Kennedy, has argued that big agriculture interests are making Americans sick. Jeff Kaufman, chairman of the Iowa Republican Party, told reporters that Trump also would be visiting the state before November's election. Kaufman, a farmer himself, played down the political damage from Trump's tariffs. Farmers understand that policies like tariffs may have some short-term pain, are going to have a long-term gain, he said. Besides competitive races for governor and Senate, two of Iowa's four congressional districts are also rated by nonpartisan analysts as toss-ups. This is an opportunity that I may not have seen in many years, said Matt Paul, a Democratic strategist in the state. Part of the state's political instability is the result of two major openings in the same election cycle. Both Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and Republican Senator Joni Ernst decided against seeking third terms. The political atmosphere has also been fueled by bipartisan angst over rising cancer rates and the closure of some medical facilities, forcing greater travel distances for care. Democrats and some doctors blame the closures on Republican-backed changes to federal health care funding. People are ready for a change, Sands said in a Fairgrounds interview when asked about his party's strength in a state that has not elected a Democratic governor since 2006. Our economy is really struggling with tariffs. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any portion of this program, you can get it on demand on our website on sunsounds.org, then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now back to our story. Sand, Iowa's only Democrat elected to statewide office, offers a potential template for others in his party on how to compete in red state America. He frequently quotes the Bible, owns two handguns, asks audiences to sing a few verses of America the Beautiful before he speaks, and has pledged to have at least one supporter of his opponent in his cabinet if elected. Independent voters will be critical for him and other Iowa Democrats. As of August 1, the state had 712,087 registered Republicans, compared with 52,758 Democrats and 559,741 independents. Our message is truly resonating with people across the political spectrum, Sands said. Republicans argue Sands' folksy appeal will wear thin once the intensity of the fall campaign season is fully engaged, and are challenging his suggestions that he is a moderate. GOP operatives in Iowa said they expect photos from Sands' brief college-age modeling career in Paris and Milan to make their way into ads. Some of the images are nearly fully nude and a bit avant-garde. Sand, in the interview, said it was a part-time job and not that different from others he had had during college. Jake Miller, a 29-year-old Eastern Iowa farmer visiting the fair, said those working in agriculture in his area are stressed a lot economically and try not to discuss the tariffs because it can lead to fights. Everyone is on their toes and being very cautious about their money, said Miller, a Trump voter who also works in farm equipment maintenance. Democrat Deb Cronin, a 36-year-old psychology professor from Des Moines attending the fair, said she is trying to keep her hopes in check in a state where Republicans in recent history have almost always been the statewide winners. I feel very, very cautiously optimistic, she said. Polls have looked good before. And on to our next story. Artificial intelligence, why big tech's AI spending is $3 trillion higher than it seems. Massive spending commitments for data center leases and chips aren't shown on companies' balance sheets. By Peter Ruggier and Peter Santilli, each quarter big tech companies disclose their massive capital expenditures on artificial intelligence infrastructure from data centers to chips. But those figures don't come close to expressing the full extent of future spending to which Google parent, Alphabet, Meta Platforms, Oracle, and many others have committed. That is because a huge swath of their coming financial obligations aren't reflected on their balance sheets. Nine top tech companies had some $3 trillion of off-balance sheet commitments, mostly related to AI, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of footnotes in their most recent security filings. Those obligations are growing faster than traditional CapEx, which totaled about $600 billion over the last year, they reported, and were about triple what the companies owe under their outstanding leases and long-term borrowings. America's blue-chip tech companies are placing these huge bets based on assumptions about what the demand for AI computing and availability of AI hardware will be in several years. Their hope is that they will easily meet all their obligations with future revenue as consumer and businesses adopt AI in every facet of American life. If those assumptions about technology and demand prove wrong, These deals to clinch future capacity could become a monstrous burden for the tech companies and their investors. Meta's gigantic Hyperion data center project in Louisiana, which is the size of about 1,700 football fields, helps explain how big obligations wind up off tech companies' balance sheets. Though Meta is the builder, neither Hyperion nor the $27 billion in debt that's financing its construction shows up on Meta's balance sheets. Funds managed by the Wall Street firm Blue Owl Capital own the majority of a joint venture that, in turn, owns the campus. BNA investor, a holding company that owns the Blue Owl stake, raised the construction financing in a bond sale. Meanwhile, Meta is Hyperion's minority partner and tenant. Its lease payments will provide the cash flows to help make the payments to bondholders. Meta initially agreed to lease Hyperion for a 4-year term, starting in 2029, with options to renew for up to 20 years. It guaranteed that it would make bondholders whole if it doesn't stay the entire 2 decades. The company doesn't think payments under that guarantee are probable, so it hasn't recorded any liability on its balance sheet. In accordance with accounting rules, Meta's Hyperion lease obligation will remain off balance sheet until it starts paying rent. It said its aggregate initial lease commitment is about $12.3 billion. Meta disclosed $347 billion in total obligations for leases that haven't kicked in yet, including for Hyperion as of June. Across the companies, the journal analyzed promises of payments under these uncommenced leases totaled $1.2 trillion in off-balance sheet obligations, or about 4 times more than what was disclosed a year earlier. In addition to Meta, the journal reviewed commitments for Alphabet, Amazon.com, Microsoft, Oracle, NVIDIA, Broadcom, SpaceX, and Advanced Micro Devices. Data centers get stuffed with a lot of hardware, including the NVIDIA chips that are used to train and run models and memory chips that store information. To buy all that, companies sign long-term contractual agreements well in advance to lock in production from their suppliers. Those and other purchase obligations at the companies the journals examine stand out at a whopping $1.9 trillion. Under accounting rules, purchase commitments typically remain off balance sheet until a product or service is delivered. Alphabet purchases, commitments, and contractual obligations have exploded and stood at $811 billion as of June 30th. As with other companies, it is hard to tell from its disclosures what precisely it intends to buy. The company said its commitments primarily relate to technical infrastructure and inventory and agreements to secure energy for data center usage. Alphabet also didn't detail why those obligations increased so much from the $332 billion it reported 3 months earlier. The commitments span several years, with obligations under its energy agreements lasting as far out as 2054. Off-balance sheet exposures at some companies include agreements to buy other companies' stock in the future or backstop leases for other tenants. NVIDIA committed to make $27 billion in equity investments between April 26 and the end of its fiscal year in January 2027. There are reasons to believe tech companies will make good on all their obligations. Optimists see the skyrocketing demand for AI tools, which has lifted the stock market and led to shortages of key hardware, as a proof point that demand is going to be strong for years and that the money to pay off all these bills will be rolling in. For the more anxious set on Wall Street, it is a worrying sign that some tech companies that once seemed to have fortress balance sheets have needed to tap the capital markets frequently. Alphabet and Amazon recently posted results showing negative free cash flow, meaning their capital spending exceeded the cash they brought in from operating their businesses. And that is before considering the implications of trillions in off-balance sheet commitments. Whether or not the revenues ever arrive, purchase commitments and signed leases can't be canceled for the most part. If things go wrong, tech companies will be paying for expensive tab for infrastructure that they can't profitably use. These obligations could also lead increasingly indebted companies to have to borrow even more. As these off-balance sheet commitments become more frequent, larger, and more complex, it is becoming increasingly difficult for investors to assess companies' total potential leverage, Morgan Stanley accounting analysts wrote in April. And on to our next story. Exclusive, markets and finance. Prosecutors focus on four businesses tied to Dodgers owner Mark Walter. Proceeds from loans made by Walter's insurers passed through firms purportedly controlled by each of these four entities, by Joe Wallace, Justin Bear, and Margot Patrick. Federal prosecutors digging into Mark Walter's business empire are focused on four entities that served as intermediaries between insurance companies he controlled that made loans on businesses that he also controlled, according to people familiar with the matter. Prosecutors and the Securities and Exchange Commission are investigating whether Walter, the chief executive of Guggenheim Partners, who owns the Los Angeles Dodgers and various other businesses, or his companies committed fraud by concealing financial connections while borrowing millions of dollars from insurers he controls. The main entities investigators have narrowed in on, the people said, are ABS Capital, a Miami outfit founded by two former Guggenheim executives, Amistad Financial, an investment company that owns Equitrust, a life insurance once controlled by Guggenheim and Walter, Bradford Allen, a Chicago-based commercial real estate brokerage with long ties to Guggenheim, and Hudson Trading, another Chicago firm. Proceeds from the loans made by the insurers passed through entities purportedly controlled by each of these firms before being used to fund other Walter-linked businesses, the people said. Walter and his businesses haven't been accused of any crimes. We have always acted in good faith, and any insinuations that we have in any way attempted to circumvent our obligation is simply false, a spokesman for TWG Global, Walter's conglomerate, said in a statement. We are proud of the business that we have built and the value we have created for our clients, investors, and shareholders. Insurance companies which invest policyholders' premiums in bonds and other debt instruments are allowed to lend to so-called affiliated entities, those with ties to insurers' owners, as long as the loans are disclosed. Following questions from prosecutors about TWG's business practices, an internal review found some $20 billion worth of unaffiliated loans that hadn't been properly disclosed. Walter's empire is now seeking to raise money, including by restructuring or selling off assets. Last weekend, an officer from Josh Kushner and Bob Iger led to him agreeing to sell the Los Angeles Lakers at a record $12.5 billion valuation, a rapid turn of events that came just 1 year after he bought the famed basketball team. Prosecutors' interest in Hudson Trading was reported earlier by Bloomberg News. The investigation comes as regulators are starting to take more interest in the opaque world of private credit, which took off after the financial crisis of 2008 to 2009 and has become a rival to banks in extending loans to businesses. A big chunk of the money fueling that industry is coming from life insurance such as the one Walter owns. Walter, 66 years old, built his fortune as one of the founders of Bonds Manager and Investment Bank Guggenheim in 1999. He helped the firm engineer the purchase of several insurance companies hobbled by the financial crisis and get them into private credit. In time, those insurers became helped finance a series of investments controlled by Walter and his partners. He led the group that bought the Dodgers in 2012 and has since amassed a collection of sports assets and investments alongside his insurance operations. Walter's insurers disclosed the investigations in June regulatory filing, and the companies have a plan to dispose of or restructure most of Walter's related investments by the end of 2026. Selling the Lakers freed up other assets and collateral that Walter had pledged to finance the team purchased last year, which might help the insurance remediation move more quickly. The Wall Street Journal reported the surprise offer wasn't part of the initial plan to become compliant with regulators, and the group continues to look for other fundraising options. Now on to our next story. Personal finance. A breakdown of the financial advice that's flying all over TikTok. We reviewed dozens of hours of influencer content, from stock pickers to financial educators, by Elise Goncalves. Open a Roth IRA, buy this stock before it pops, make $100,000 a month by starting your own side hustle. The sea of financial advice courses through TikTok's user phones each day. This money-minded self-help is far more widely available and less regulated than the traditional financial services industry, and it is increasingly driving the way people manage their money. Fidelity Investment credits these financial influencers in part for the skyrocketing number of people who are opening Roth IRAs and the 73% rise in contributing to them among Gen Z year-over-year in the second quarter of 2026. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority found that those who use social media for investment advice rate their investment knowledge higher than those who don't, but perform worse on an objective knowledge test. They are also more susceptible to investment fraud. Investors should come at the information with the same skeptical eye, said Gary Motella, FINRA's director of research. Is this information I can trust? Is it reliable? To give a taste of the financial advice one might encounter on TikTok, we scraped the social media app for accounts that had tagged their videos with one of a handful of widely used money hashtags, including hashtag investing and hashtag personal finance, on July 13th. We reviewed nearly 50 hours of content across 212 accounts that offered money advice. A majority of accounts we reviewed were run by people who don't appear to have a financial license or certification as an advisor. Many display high balances in their investment accounts to signal that they are trustworthy. Others showcase their lavish lives. Some ask viewers to learn alongside them. Here's a list of what we saw. The educators. Many accounts are focused on offering financial advice to beginners who have no money management experience. Humphrey Yang's account recommends buying and holding index funds for life and opening a high-yield savings account. Yang, 38, also explains financial concepts in his videos. Like Yang, dozens of accounts we reviewed had videos focused on opening a Roth IRA or told users to give priority to exchange-traded funds in their investment portfolios. One guy saw me in an airport and said, "Hey, I've been investing since I've been watching you, and now I'm taking a year off to go travel the world because I've saved up enough money and I've set my future up already," Yang said. "I think those are the most fulfilling conversations." Yang is rare among money influencers and having a finance background. He was a financial advisor before he became an influencer 7 years ago, and now he has more than 3 million followers and 50 million likes across his videos. Despite his technical experience, Yang said most of his content is based on questions he has had or his own individual wealth strategies, similar to creators with less experience. Still, Yang cautioned against trusting accounts that promise returns over a short time frame. It is a long-term game, and even, let's say you make $1 million a year really quickly, if you don't have the right financial habits, you could probably just blow it the next year, Yang said. The Young Guns. Leo Gibson, a UK-based content creator, decided to give viewers 21 pieces of money and life advice before he turned 21. He compiled clips from his life, set it to music, and recorded a voiceover telling people how he learned to make his money matter more. He figured it would appeal to younger viewers with short attention spans. The video has reached nearly 500,000 views. Gibson tells his viewers, primarily young fellow members of Gen Z, to invest in index funds and get a credit card, but spend only the money you have. Our review found a lot of young people on TikTok directing their financial advice to other young people. Gibson often regurgitates messages from personal finance and investing books that he has read or from YouTube videos he watches about finance for beginners. When the information is coming from a 21-year-old lad from the UK who is sat in a hoodie and a cap, it feels a lot more relatable than someone in a suit and a big wooden office trying to get the same point across, Gibson said. Many young finfluencers make series like Gibson's. Others make short lists of places to cut costs for viewers to follow. The videos tend to contain simple changes for people to improve their lives and spending. The stock hypers. Of the 212 accounts we reviewed, nearly a third made recommendations about individual stocks or talked about their portfolio holdings. That advice ranged from talking about safe investments for long-term holdings to recommendations to buy individual stocks before they popped. Timothy James, 38, who recommends stocks and offers market predictions on TikTok and Substack, has recently posted videos claiming the market is approaching a peak and predicting a meltdown in the future. On July 16th, James predicted that PBF Energy and Sunoco LP, two energy companies, would see short-term runs. PBS has ridden double digits and Sunoco has risen more than 6%. But James said he has only one guarantee for viewers. I will pick a loser at some point. He posted in late July about holding T1 Energy, another energy stock that's now down 54% in his portfolio. James has been making content for almost 6 years, and he said he's seen influencers come and go after market upturns and downturns. James says he has noticed younger viewers often gravitate toward fast-paced content and advice. His audience is mostly millennials. The older people can usually see through the baloney pretty quickly, but the young people not so much, James said. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia found that 41% of people who got their financial advice from social media have a high level of trust in the content. James said he used rage-baiting lines to draw in viewers before because he knows what drives attention to his account. He said he tries to be careful with his language to make sure that viewers understand that his predictions aren't guarantees, using words like high probability and odds are to avoid giving assured recommendations. Not everyone is so careful. In some videos, day traders post about successful quick trades that they have made. Others display their short-term gains as proof of their stock-picking ability. In recent months, James has taken aim at content like this. He said many of them are focused on view counts and followers instead of offering trustworthy information. The show-offs. Brittany Bowen's TikTok page is filled with videos of her sitting in her new car, unboxing gifted packages from brands and speaking to the camera as she gets ready for the day. Wedged between those videos are messages about personal finance. She teases much of her advice on TikTok, but most of it comes with a cost. Bowen, 29, has a business built on teaching interested followers to create content, monetize social media accounts, and about how to invest. She tells her viewers to put their money into artificial intelligence and tech companies and start making passive income, like she's done by selling the lessons she has created online. Part of that means inviting viewers to see her lifestyle. In an interview, Bowen said her new Mercedes, which she has flaunted in numerous TikToks, cost just over $100,000. She wouldn't have bought it if it weren't for her influencer platform, she said. Posting stuff like that is a marketing tactic, Bowen said. You have to show people the result of what their life could be if they do what you've done. Bowen makes her money from her course for women, which has 625 participants. Many are looking to understand how to open an investment account or to read stock charts, so she teaches them for just under $300. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.